From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today, it's an all-science edition of the show. We begin with writer and scientist Sean Carroll, who talks about a necessary quality in his profession.
I think scientists are by nature optimistic, and there's really no alternative to optimism because that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Then a recent study looks at the way our minds store and recall short-term memories.
Then getting older isn't for the faint-hearted, and it turns out it's not for the faint-muscled either.
Older adults are usually more fatigable, particularly in their lower limbs, than young people. So there's this problem of greater fatigability, lack of strength, and that's sort of a general issue that we're trying to address.
And a local researcher talks about the ethical issues with the data you generate online and how it can be used. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Every year, UW-Milwaukee's College of Letters and Science welcomes an award-winning scientist, writer, and educator from Wisconsin to speak at the Dean's Distinguished Lecture in the Natural Sciences. This year's speaker was Sean Carroll.
Carroll is the Alan Wilson Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics at UW-Madison, and he's also the author of the book The Serengeti Rules. The book uses true stories of scientific discovery to explain how scientists connected the dots and came to understand that all of life is interconnected. Ahead of his appearance in Milwaukee back in October, we reached him via Skype. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, always a pleasure to talk with you. And this time it's about a new book called The Serengeti Rules. And I suppose we should start right there. What are the Serengeti Rules and why should we care about them?
The Serengeti Rules is really a label I applied to some basic discoveries about how the world works on the larger scale, on the ecological scale. The rules that determine the numbers and kinds of, say, animals and plants that live in any given place. And we should care because understanding those rules has to do with how we manage the places that supply us with what we need. You know, we're animals and we need animals and plants for food and for maintaining the places that we live. And if we don't do that well, bad things happen.
Right. And a lot of people saying bad things are happening because we have ignored those rules. Do we understand those rules implicitly or do we have to have them spelled out to us?
Oh, no, I think we have to have them spelled out because there are a lot of surprises. So and we should, you know, rather than bashing ourselves too much, you know, we didn't understand a lot about how nature worked, say, 50 years ago. I mean, it was pretty obvious you didn't want to just destroy it and pollute the heck out of it. But we really didn't understand the interactions that take place in various habitats. And we wouldn't understand, for example, how carnivores, right, meat eaters, influence the abundance of plants. Mm-hmm. Huh? Yes, that's exactly the response one might have. But 5 decades or so ago, pioneering work by folks like Bob Payne, a late ecologist at the University of Washington, Seattle, started to understand those connections, that some animals have disproportionately large effects on other creatures in various habitats. And when those animals are perturbed, there can be really big ripple effects.
I think it's understanding that the sort of synergistic, you use the word regulation a lot in the book, and how all of this has rules and regulations that need to be, I mean, there's some slack, but that really need to be followed in order for things to sort of hum along the way they're supposed to.
Sure. I mean, you know, Wisconsin's a place with lots of freshwater lakes, right? And we've all become used to, for example, the scene of a lake that's absolutely choked green with algae. And we're like, well, you know, I'm not going to swim in it. I'm not going to fish in it. I'm not going to let my dog, you know, run through it, et cetera. But that's not at all normal. That's a lake that's sick. That's a pond that's sick. What's happened is that the algae have overwhelmed the controls, the regulations that are in place that otherwise balance what's going on in a pond. And now that pond is no longer productive. It's not doing the sort of things that it can be doing for humans and for other creatures in the area. But these are reversible things. In fact, it was University of Wisconsin researchers maybe 3 decades ago starting to experiment on some lakes up north, learned how to flip these lakes, to switch them from turbid green to clearer and more productive and containing more fish kinds of lakes. So we don't have to put up with this, and it's not, you know, we don't necessarily have to radically change our lifestyles or anything like that. We can do a better job at maintaining the places that sustain us, both, you know, whether that's because we like to eat fish or swim in the water or whatever it might be. But we could have a lot nicer fresh water all across North America if we gave it a shot.
Yeah, you mentioned Lake Erie as one of the examples, and having grown up on it and knowing not to even touch it, let alone eat anything from it or drink from it directly.
Yeah, I grew up on the edge of it in Toledo, Ohio, and I never ate anything that came out of Lake Erie, never swam in Lake Erie. You know, it was in really bad shape, you know, pretty much notorious in our culture. But that's not the way, you know, things should be. That's not the way things need to be. Lake Mendota, to my surprise, I didn't even know about this until actually fairly recently, but the year I arrived at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, one of the largest ecological experiments ever undertaken was going on in Lake Mendota to flip its state from something that was getting pretty grungy, you know, early in the summer, and where a lot of fish populations had crashed, to try to restore the clarity of the lake, try to restore the balance of fish populations. And it was an experiment that was largely successful, done right under the, you know, public eye in terms of the city of Madison and fish enthusiasts and, of course, the state government. So, again, you got to know the rules, and those rules have been worked out by ecologists that understand the effect that one species has on another and another in sort of a chain reaction type way. And if you don't know those rules, if you don't know those interactions, you really don't understand the game, and you're blind to the effects that you might be having.
Do we ever get to a point, though, where we have messed it up too far and we can't correct for it? I mean, I think about the Amazon, for example. Are we going to get to the point where we cut too much of it down and we just can't save it?
You might. Funny you bring it up. I was in the Amazon last month, and for the first time ever, and with my own eyes, finally saw the vastness of part of it. And it is breathtakingly enormous. The amount of water, it is just hard to, I just can't describe it. I needed even an aerial tour by seaplane to just get some sense of all these rivers. And because a lot of the area floods seasonally, that does limit human development. And Brazil and other countries have caught on that the Amazon sort of makes its own weather. That's how big and complex it is. And trees play a big part in that. And so the destruction of the Amazon has abated to a certain degree as governments have realized that it's in their own worst interest to, you know, sort of continue the path that we're on. So it is possible to destroy things, but in the book, I talk about some places that were essentially left for dead, that were decimated, for example, of wildlife. A place in particular that I've been, I know well, is in Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique in southeastern Africa. It was a jewel of Mozambique, a place where the jet setters, the Hollywood types, went in the 1960s because of great concentration of wildlife in the center of the park, elephants and buffalo and hippos and lions. After 20 years of civil war, essentially all that was gone, from thousands of elephants to 50, from thousands of hippos to fewer than 100, from 14,000 buffalo to fewer than 100, you know, just decimated. And people thought that it was, you know, a lost cause. But starting in 2004, an American philanthropist named Greg Carr teamed up with the government of Mozambique, and they've been trying to bring Gorongosa back. And the wildlife populations in that time span have gone from about 1,000 large mammals of all types. If you add up the antelope, the elephants, the buffalo, et cetera, there were about 1,000 in 2004. There are 71,000 in 2015. So it's roaring back. And so we know this in other cases. There have been species hunted to almost extinction, like elephant seals in the Pacific, down to about 20. They're back to 200,000. Other species that have experienced protection, you can see sometimes, you know, just an explosive rebound. So I guess it ain't over till they're extinct. And extinct means zero, and that's it. But there are lots of cases of being brought back from the brink of extinction. And, you know, I don't say that to just, you know, gloss over the challenges, but you know, we do have to have some hope based in experience, and those experiences are out there.
Well, what about the human animal? One of the chapters you're talking about how populations regenerate, and I'm thinking, you know, we've eradicated so much of what used to kill us. And right. And because of that, our population has exponentially exploded and doesn't seem to be slowing down terribly much globally. Do we get to the point where there's just too many of us and that can't come back?
Yeah, I think that's a serious issue. You know, at 7 billion plus, there's a term in ecology, the carrying capacity. So, you know, how much can the planet produce, you know, for us and the other things that we depend upon? You know, we're a pretty big animal by animal standards, you know, at 150, 180 pounds, you know, or larger. And, you know, we consume a lot and we now live a long time. And so if you visited 200 years ago from, you know, another planet and then you visited today, you'd go, wow, those large two-legged beasts have really spread all over the place. But we're animals. We need food. We need water, right? We need shelter. You know, we need rainfall to grow that food. And, you know, we can see in various parts of the world, the ability of the land and water to support us is being strained. And that's, I mean, don't even, before we even mention climate change, that's the situation just from routine human activity without the added complexity of climate change. And so we just have to be mindful that we are taxing the Earth's ability to supply us with what we need. And I think there's, you know, essentially regional crises in the ability of those parts of the globe to support their populations.
It seems like we have somehow managed to outwit the regulators and the regulations, and the rest of nature hasn't caught up with us.
Well, that's true. I mean, the regulation for us has generally been disease, mm-hmm. and the story of medicine for the last century has been, you know, especially to eliminate and reduce childhood diseases so that people make it through childhood, they live a longer life. Life expectancy has, you know, almost doubled, you know, since the turn of the last century. That's very dramatic, as and our population has grown somewhat around fourfold. Agriculture is so much more efficient. So we're an incredible, I mean, you can look at it, there's two sides of the coin. We're an incredibly clever species. And being able and having figured out ways to, you know, improve our chances of survival, you know, shelter and public sanitation and vaccination and antibiotics and all sorts of things. But we haven't quite fully turned that cleverness to designing sustainable systems that will, you know, feed us and provide water and all that sort of thing without degrading those resources. So the book, I talk about stories of various places in the world that are, you know, beautiful and interesting and all that, but it's really about, it's not so much about making the world pretty as making it functional and making it able to support us. And, you know, certainly, you know, not causing, you know, greater harm than necessary in doing so. And that just means, you know, just being a little smarter, a little better informed about how we behave. Maybe even not a little, but I think, you know, recognize that nature has rules and regulations, and so humans need them too.
Are you hopeful that we will learn these rules and regulations in time?
It's a great question. I think scientists are by nature optimistic, and a lot of the people I know, including somebody I talk about in the book, Greg Carr, you know, doesn't see there's really no alternative to optimism because that's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, I think a lot of life is about trying. Right. No matter what walk of life you're in, you know, we're always striving, you know, whether we're trying to, you know, master an instrument or, you know, learn to paint or be a better gardener or whatever it might be. And, you know, collectively, we're striving to be a wiser society and to, you know, hand off the world in no worse shape, I would say, than we inherited it. But, you know, that takes some self-sacrifice, that takes some planning, that takes some, you know, collective action. But we've done a lot of things together in the past. One of the stories I talk about in the book is the eradication, the only human disease that's been eradicated from the planet, which is smallpox. And this was a terrifying, massively deadly disease for most of civilized human history. No one thought you could eradicate that from the planet, but an 11-year effort from 1966 to 1977 involved hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people across the globe working in the most, you know, remote villages everywhere. Eradicated it, gone from the planet. it was during the Cold War, and Russia and the United States cooperated, and a lot of countries that weren't even members of, you know, the World Health Organization cooperated and things like that. So even in times when, you know, the world has been in a fair amount of turmoil, we've pulled together to accomplish some things. And I think that, you know, more and more people are aware that what we're doing is not often sustainable. You know, we're draining the groundwater out of California. You know, that's going to catch up to us. You're not going to be able to grow all those crops in the Central Valley. We're following lakes and rivers that we'd like to be not only just to enjoy, but also to be productive and to have water that we can, you know, rely upon for irrigation and things like that. So, you know, it's hard in, you know, in the, with all the present pressures to plan for the future, but, you know, it's something that we're smart enough to do.
Sean Carroll is the Alan Wilson Professor of Molecular Biology and Genetics at UW-Madison. He's also Vice President for Science Education at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Maryland and the author of The Serengeti Rules, The Quest to Discover How Life Works and Why It Matters.
Well, what if something could bring memories back to mind? Something can and did in an experiment documented by local researchers. We'll learn more about it next here on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. We've all experienced the momentary panic of forgetting where we dropped our keys or reading glasses or having a thought, a word or a name or just a concept just out of reach.
So what if something could make you remember something your mind had already forgotten? Well, local researchers attempted to do just that in a recent experiment documented in a new study released earlier this month.
Brad Postel is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison and the senior author of the study. He starts by explaining how our brains store memories.
One of the things that we've learned over the past several years is that there are many different kinds of memory. But assuming that you mean long-term memory that we typically think about, like my memory for my mother's middle name or my memory for my phone number, that information is stored in patterns of connections between neurons. Those connections are called synapses. And a synapse can be strengthened or weakened as a result of experience. And we think that memories, in effect, are networks of connections between neurons where the connections at synapses have been sculpted in an exquisitely precise way to encode the information that we will later retrieve and think of as a memory.
So how does our long-term memory compare to what your study really looked at, these working memories?
Right. So long-term memory, as far as we know, has an infinite storage capacity. It has never been discovered that someone literally had so much information in their memory that they couldn't fit one more thing. I don't think that can happen. Working memory, on the other hand, has a very constrained capacity of about, depending on the kind of information, if it's verbal information or verbalizable information, like the numbers of a telephone, for example, a telephone number, we can remember on the order of 7 to 9 items. If it's visual information, like shapes or faces, we can hold in working memory more like 3 or 4 items.
So when we say remembering something, when I use the term remembering something, what does that actually look like in our brains when we're talking about working memories versus long-term memories?
Yeah. Well, I think it doesn't look different. So remembering something means retrieving information that's stored in your brain. But if we go back to the example of your mother's middle name, for example, presumably, before you called me 5 minutes ago, you weren't thinking of your mother's middle name. Presumably, you are right now because I just mentioned it. And so that information was in what I would call a latent state. It was in your brain, but it wasn't active. You weren't thinking about it, and it wasn't physiologically active. When you're thinking about it, you have networks in your brain that represent the sound of your mother's middle name. There are areas of your brain that represent what the shape of the letters of the alphabet are that make up your mother's middle name. You have areas of your brain that correspond to the emotions that you feel when you think about your mother. And those are all activated at the same time in concert. And the activation of that corresponds to your having retrieved the memory of your mother's middle name. Now, working memory reflects the fact that if I didn't know your mother's middle name, let's say it was Edith. I'm just making that up.
It's Gay, actually.
Gay, okay. Well, so I didn't know what your mother's middle name was. And if you gave me a list of common middle names, so if you gave me Gay, Edith, Ross, pretty soon I would no longer be able to keep track of, did you say Edith before or after Gay? Was it Edith or was it Emily? So my ability to keep everything in the forefront of my mind, as it were, to have it accessible so that I could use it, for example, to read back to you, to recite back to you the list of names, that's a very limited capacity, and that's what we call working memory.
So let's look at this actual study. What was your hypothesis going into it?
Right. So we know that you can hold, let's say, 3 or 4 items simultaneously. And one recent development with neuroimaging studies is that there are what we call information-based analysis techniques that, in effect, let us read your brain in a primitive sense. So if I show you a picture of a face and a picture of a series of letters that make up a pronounceable word and a pattern of dots that are moving in a certain direction, we can measure activity in your brain and learn how those patterns are distinctive from each other, so that if somebody then were to say, okay, I'm showing the research subject a picture of one of those three things, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, we would be able to, with a high degree of reliability, say, oh, she's looking at a picture of a face, or she's looking at a word, or she's looking at moving dots. So we have been able to track the real-time storage of 3 visual items. So our common sense tells us, and laboratory studies tell us, that we can hold multiple items in an active state. The particular study that we did, however, was one where we gave the subject 2 items to remember, and then after the items were no longer presented, and so 2 items were in memory, we told the subject, we're going to test your memory for item number 1 first. Now, they weren't supposed to forget item number 2, because after we tested their memory for item number 1, there was a 50% chance that then we would test their memory for item number 2. So they had to hold it in memory, but item number 1 was prioritized because that was going to be tested first.
And these items are pictures of people or words or what have you.
Exactly. They were drawn from those 3 categories that I mentioned. So the direction of moving dots. And so if the dots are moving, let's say, in the 9 o'clock direction on the clock, and then 5 seconds later, I show you a patch of dots that are moving in the 8:30 direction, you would say, no, that doesn't match because it's not identical to what you had just seen. And similarly, if I show you a face during the test phase, you have to say yes or no, is this an exact match of the face that I just saw? So we do that with those 3 categories, with motion, with faces, and with words. The interesting thing to us is that in this situation where you have 2 items in memory, but you know that only one of them is going to be tested within the next few seconds, the evidence of an active representation of the unprioritized item, the item that I've called number 2, disappears. And so it's as though you forgot about it, even though if a few seconds later we say, okay, now get ready for a test about item number 2, we can see in your brain activity, it pops right back up into an active state.
And this is what in the study you're calling an attended memory item and an unattended memory item.
Precisely, yeah. So both items are in memory, but only one is currently prioritized in your focus of attention.
Now, If I'm getting this right, in the study you said a targeted pulse of transcranial magnetic stimulation, which to me sounds like zapping someone's brain with a magnet, which I don't know if that's quite right, but that restored someone's memory.
What it did was it transiently brought back into an active state that unattended memory item. So remember I told you that the evidence for an active trace of the item that was still in memory but not currently the focus of attention had disappeared. And the pulse of TMS, of transcranial magnetic stimulation, had the effect of briefly bringing back an active trace of that unattended memory item.
How does it do that?
Yeah. Well, we have ideas about how it does that. We aren't yet in a position where we can prove how it happens. But the idea is something like this. We talked about the fact at the beginning of this interview that a memory consists of a specific pattern of weighted connection between neurons. So different synapses have different strengths, which means different strengths of connections between different areas of your brain that represent, say, your emotional memories of your mother and what your mother looked like and so forth. We think that memory retrieval, in effect, is the reactivation of those different areas of your brain that all together in concert correspond to the memory of your mother's middle name. And in effect, the way that you're able to retrieve that information is that the patterns of the specific patterns of different strengths of synapses, in effect, guide the neural activity, the neural activation into just the right pattern so that just the right neurons get goosed and therefore just the right pattern of activity is produced.
How did the participants in this study describe the kind of feeling of a memory being retrieved?
Well, they don't actually know that it's happening. So they feel this this crack on their scalp, which is kind of like if you had, let's say somebody was holding a cutting board against your head and they gently tapped it with a spoon. That's roughly what it would feel like on your scalp. So they're aware of that, and they're aware that they're doing the experiment. They're not aware of the fact that this information was temporarily activated, but we set up our experiment in such a way that we could determine whether it was in fact activated by how subjects responded on the memory test. So in effect, when we delivered a pulse of TMS, it was as though we fooled the subject into thinking that the unattended memory item was the attended memory item.
So what are the implications of this study?
Right. So to get back to your earlier question, the thing about the TMS that makes it exciting is that instead of you spontaneously, volitionally choosing to retrieve a memory, we think that what we're doing is, in effect, artificially retrieving a memory by delivering this pulse of activity to the right part of your brain. And that activity gets channeled through these weighted patterns of synapses and activates all the right neurons, and the memory comes back. And so in principle, if we get a better handle on precisely how this works, if we can predict that memory A but not memory B or memory C might be reactivated with a certain pattern of pulses, if we're able to do it in such a way that subjects do become aware of the memories that we activated, so at this point, they're not aware of it. We alter their behavior, thereby demonstrating that we did activate it, but we don't actually bring it into their back into their awareness. If we figure out how to do that, then in principle, you could imagine treatment for different types of psychiatric disease. So depression is associated with rumination, where the patients pathologically think about negative things and are unable to sort of break out of that pattern of negative thinking. Patients with schizophrenia sometimes will experience hallucinations, which is, in effect, paying attention to internal noise inside your head instead of paying attention to the outside world. So if these psychiatric diseases are in fact associated with difficulty controlling what one thinks about, difficulty controlling attention to different thoughts that are zooming around in your head, then maybe this would point the way towards an approach whereby we could help people to regain control over what they choose to think about at any given moment in time.
It sounds like something out of Eternal Sunshine for the Spotless Mind.
Yeah, I would have to revisit the movie to know if the analogy is exact. But, you know, it's exciting for us. For me, I've been really interested in consciousness for a long time. You know, what is the combination of electrical and chemical interactions that give rise to this feeling that both you and I are experiencing right now of being a person and sitting in a radio studio and seeing a microphone and so forth, you know, the experience itself. And that's a really hard question to study scientifically. It's easier to study things like how do people remember a face for a few seconds. But when you think about it, if I'm studying how do you remember a face versus a word, part of what I'm doing is studying what the subject is holding in her conscious awareness during those couple of seconds that I'm asking her to remember a particular face. And so this experiment, in a way, I think is getting us closer to those really deep questions about what gives rise to this incredible experience that is what makes us human.
Brad, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect, and thanks for sharing your work.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Brad Postal is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison. He's the senior author of the study Reactivation of Latent Working Memories with Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation.
A short break now, and then we'll learn about a new study that's looking at how exercise affects the aging process. Stick around for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. An all-science edition of Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The old saying goes that nothing is certain but death and taxes. Well, we can add another certainty to that list. Our muscles will weaken and even atrophy as we age unless we take care of them by strength building and exercise. In other words, you really do need to move it or lose it.
Last year, Marquette University received a $2.8 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to fund research on how decreased muscle mass can lead to increased fatigue in aging populations and how a novel exercise program can address these effects.
Dr. Sandra Hunter is a professor of exercise science at Marquette University's College of Health Sciences, and Dr. Robert Fitz is a professor of biological sciences. They explain how they're studying the effects of exercise in older adults and the greater implications it could have.
Older adults have difficulty with many daily tasks, such as going upstairs, even getting out of a chair, and that's usually a strength-limited issue. They also have difficulty with tasks that are needing a lot of sort of fatiguing contractions. And so older adults are usually more fatigable, particularly in their lower limbs, than young people. And so there's this problem of greater fatigability, lack of strength, and that's sort of a general issue that we're trying to address with this grant in two ways. One, by trying to look at or examining the causes of that greater fatigability and lack of strength. And secondly, by a program of sort of a new novel program of exercise that we're going to implement.
And what are the greater implications for quality of life in older adults if they do not strengthen their muscles?
Well, one of the big problems is muscle mass decreases particularly rapidly after age 70. And so if they don't try to prevent that change, they get limited in their muscle mass and muscle power from the point of view of even doing daily activities like getting out of a chair and walking to the kitchen, yeah, for example.
So something that, like an activity that might be, you know, take, say, 50% of your strength, for instance, I won't say mine, but yours because you're young. But for an older adult who's 70 plus, it might be close to 100% of their strength. And so increasing the muscle mass will at least address some of those issues and give them more a bit of a buffer between what they're able to do and what's required.
And given this buffer, will this help stave off some of the paths people need to take, such as assisted living or further medications, surgeries that may come about in older age?
One of the things it'll likely do, and we think it'll do, is that it would increase strength, or at least a decrease in loss of strength. They're less likely to fall, break hips, break bones, and therefore less likely to end up in a hospital.
Okay. Yeah, a really interesting fact is that people who have older adults who have low strength have a greater chance of mortality, and that's a really well-known fact now.
And so what techniques are you utilizing in your research to tap into these problems and finding potential solutions? I've read there's such a thing called transcranial magnetic stimulation or magnetic resonance spectroscopy, as far as I know. So for all of us, what are these two techniques and what does it do in your research?
Okay, so Bob and I are taking a really collaborative approach here. I do the whole body science and he does the molecular or the cellular science. So the whole body science, we're using transcranial magnetic stimulation. We're stimulating the brain to try and understand the integrity of the nervous system and fatigue that occurs within the nervous system as young and older adults are doing, you know, some type of fatiguing contraction, say, with their lower limb. We're also using magnetic resonance spectroscopy, which is a technique in the magnet, and we're doing that out at MCW, where we can examine the metabolism of the muscle during exercise. So that's sort of the whole body exercise that we're looking at. Bob, on the other hand, is doing some pretty cool techniques in his lab where we get bits of muscle. We take muscle biopsies from the leg muscles of these participants before and after training, and then he can talk to the single fiber work that he's going to be doing.
Well, I would just say that the spectral work will tell us exactly what's going on with the various substrates within the muscle. And my lab has studied muscle fatigue for many years, and we're sort of guessing at what are those changes in, for example, glycogen or lactic acid or hydrogen and various factors that are known to cause fatigue. And so we'll be able to take that data and then with the muscle biopsy data and isolating the single cells, we'll be able to study those fibers under those conditions and see how they've been altered by the aging process and ultimately how they're protected against that with the training.
How many different ages of muscle groups are you studying? Is it just in the older participants or do you have a range of people?
We have a range, but we're going to have a younger a group because we need to compare it to, you know, what is the changes over years of life. And so we'll have a younger group, men and women, and we'll have older groups. And those groups will be divided into degrees of age. In other words, there's big differences between 70 to 80 and 80 to 90 plus.
And in addition to studying the effects of aging and exercise for nerves and strength in the muscles, how does your exercise training program address this issue?
Well, classically, training has been built around to protect muscle mass, high resistance exercise, such as weightlifting in the gym, where you might do a maximal lift with heavy weight and do it very rapidly. Evidence coming out a few years ago suggests that they might get better protection, especially in particular muscle fiber types that are dominating in the elderly, which is a slower type, with slower contractions, but built on a contraction that's still generating peak power. So this is a novel training, and it's a key part of our project.
So what kind of exercise do you have your participants doing?
So they'll do the basic types of exercise that are currently done, like, for example, squats. But instead of doing the squat in a second, they'll do the squat with 6 seconds going down and 6 seconds coming up. And that'll give you a 12-second stress on the muscle fibers rather than a 2-second stress. And we believe and we have data to suggest that that will increase protein synthesis and therefore better protect the muscle mass. With aging, we know that there's an increased number of slower type fibers and a reduced number of the faster type fibers. And these two fiber types are benefited by training in different ways. And the longer contraction is more beneficial to the slower fiber type, which is the fiber type predominating in older adults.
With your firsthand experience in studying these effects and noticing the trends of aging firsthand through this research, what is your advice to older adults in the community right now to stem off this muscle deterioration that you're trying to fight?
Well, my first advice is to keep active. Once you start losing muscle mass and get inactive, it's a vicious cycle of loss. So the key is to maintain activity at whatever level you're able to, and also maintain flexibility. So flexibility and muscle power are really the things that decline rapidly with age, and those are the things we need to be concerned about.
Yeah. Old muscle and is quite adaptable. It's people should not be afraid of that. And so there's a bit of a fear factor, and there's, you know, these myths that older adults don't adapt as well, and that's just not true. We've done studies where we've looked at the adaptability of both young and old, and the older adults are just as adaptable, both within their central nervous system but also within the muscle. And Bob's absolutely right. Keep active, because it can make an enormous difference.
What kind of response have you seen in your participants so far?
We've been putting ads out in the paper, and we've had quite a few people enroll in the studies that we've got going so far. At the moment, we're just at the phase where we're doing the cross-sectional study, where we're examining the differences between young and old. We haven't yet implemented the training program, but we're going to start ramping that up next year. So if there's anyone out there who wants to join and who wants to enroll in our studies, they are most welcome.
I'll consider this a public service announcement call.
Absolutely. We need healthy older adults.
Well, great. Thank you so much for coming in today, Sandra and Bob.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great being here.
Dr. Sandra Hunter and Dr. Robert Fitz of Marquette University were awarded a $2.8 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study the effects of aging and exercise.
We will take one last break, and then we'll hear from a local research ethicist who's raising some questions about the use of big data from social media sites. That's right here on Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Every time you post to Twitter or Facebook, these sites are collecting data about you. At this point, you ought to expect that by participating in social media sites, you're giving up some of your privacy. It's just kind of the name of the game.
Well, some see big data from social media sites as a godsend for researchers. It's a perfect way to study social habits with huge numbers of people. But what happens when that data, with your personal details still attached, is published for a study for the world to see?
Well, a data set released earlier this year from the dating site OkCupid raised the ire of one local research ethicist. Michael Zimmer is faculty at UW-Milwaukee's School of Information Studies, and he's the director of the Center for Information Policy Research. He starts by explaining the release and why it raises some ethical concerns.
The interesting thing with this OkCupid study was the fact that it's one in the pattern of researchers who are studying social media data and then releasing it to the public, with this presumption that the data is already out there. And a lot of the work that I've done in the past has been looking at how either this kind of research is done improperly, where the researchers had to log into a system or somehow gain access to a system in order to retrieve this data, or that the users just never had this kind of expectation that by joining a platform like OkCupid, that their information could be gathered and amassed and released out to the public in such a manner.
Yeah, that was one of my questions. I mean, when people sign up for things like OkCupid or Twitter or Facebook, are they given the information that, yeah, your whatever you put here might be used later for research?
Yeah, that's a complicated problem. And a lot of times users don't fully understand what they're signing up for. Or I understand that Twitter is a platform where I'm going to share 140 character messages, but it gets kind of lost in the sea of all the thousands of other messages that came out at the same very moment. And don't really have a clear understanding that that stuff could be archived and then perhaps later accessed by someone. So there's this issue about whether or not users fully understand the nature of the platforms. But there is that research side, like you mentioned. Very few of the social media platforms have a clause in the terms of service or in the agreements that you sign that say, and oh, by the way, we're going to let researchers access this data. Occasionally, the companies themselves may use it. They might want to test a change to their interface or how, you know, the font they use, and they want to be able to do some internal research. But typically, if researchers want to have access to data, they have to go through some other kind of formal processes. There's different kinds of tools that the platforms provide researchers to give them limited sets of data, usually anonymized data. In this particular case, the researcher just logged in and started grabbing data just haphazardly, and that's where the real problem was.
So we do know how they got the data, because initially you were saying, or they said they used a bot.
Right. It's still a little bit unclear. And this is a researcher who I've learned after the fact tends to be a little bit rogue, perhaps, kind of doing his own thing. That's actually one of the interesting dangers in this environment, that it's really easy for just about anybody to get this kind of data. You don't have to be a computer scientist with years of experience and all kinds of expensive computers. But what it sounds like they did is that they first used an automated bot to try to create a fake profile and find people on OkCupid. And when someone becomes visible, they had a script that would scrape all that data and put it into a database. And then later it turned out that didn't seem to be doing what they wanted it to do. And the solution that they ultimately chose is actually quite unclear in the draft paper that they put online. So we're not exactly sure how they did it, which is actually another one of the problems that for good research, you're going to explain your methods a little bit better so it can go under peer review and scrutiny. And this researcher just seemed to fail on a number of different levels in that regard.
And one of the problems that you mentioned, as someone who has signed up for OkCupid and used it in the past, you do have the ability to set your profile.
Right.
So it can only be viewed by other users. So you have the assumption of some kind of privacy, that it's not open to the world at large, only other people who are seeking out partners on OkCupid.
Right. And that's important both like in a technical sense and also in sort of a broader psychological sense. I mean, technically, you're right. When you set up an OkCupid profile, you can make it visible only to other users. And that's a way to sort of manage your privacy. I don't want it to be visible on Google just when you're logged in. So when a researcher like this says, well, this stuff is already public, what he kind of really means is like this stuff was visible to other users who happened to also create a profile. And those aren't the same thing. But also psychologically, I think it's important for users when they sign up for this thing, they have this assumption or these set of expectations that I know this data is like kind of public, but it's meant for this community. I'm creating this profile and sharing it because I'm assuming everyone else is creating profiles and sharing. And we have this kind of like mutual exchange. And doing this kind of research sometimes violates that assumption. And to me, that's a problem that we as researchers at least need to stop and think about. And I'm not convinced this particular researcher did.
So one of the things in his study in particular, he didn't make the users anonymous.
Correct.
So he essentially, he publishes all this information about them. And he also keeps their name attached to that.
Right. Yeah. Whatever name or email address or any kind of personal information that was part of their profile stayed with this data that he released.
I mean, with studies like this, have we heard from any of the people who have had their information published who have said, wait, 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 I didn't think that this was going to be used that way?
In this particular study, we haven't, and also because this only happened a few weeks ago, and we may not have heard from enough people. I've done other research, and I've looked at other studies. There was one study where there was a set of students at Harvard that were included in a piece of research, and there I heard from some people, behind closed doors that I was actually a part of this data set, and this troubles me. The most famous case is actually from a number of years ago when AOL was still a search engine, and they released data to academic researchers to help study how people use search engines. And they actually removed people's names and their email addresses, but all the records still had unique identifiers. And the New York Times was actually able to re-identify one of those people just by piecing together their search queries, because people often search for their address or their name or their other kinds of things. And they could actually re-identify someone even when AOL took the steps to try to anonymize that data set. And that shows how complicated this is. This researcher didn't take any steps to anonymize. But even when we do take steps to anonymize, sometimes that's imperfect.
So it's difficult to anonymize the data, but at the same time, the use of this kind of data is becoming increasingly more popular. And it also reveals a lot of information that I think people would find valuable.
Mm-hmm.
How do we temper that desire with, you know, the realities of anonymizing this information and keeping those identities safe?
There is a growing interest in studying this kind of data. Social media data, internet data is a valuable resource for different kinds of academic disciplines. And there's also a large movement for making this data public. There's an open data movement in order to allow us to scrutinize these kinds of studies by making the data sets that we use visible and accessible for everyone. But you have this challenge, like you mentioned, about how do we make sure that we're protecting the people that are in this data? How do we make sure we have anonymity? There are a lot of people working in computer science and mathematics to try to help us make our data sets more anonymous in terms of the technology. But we also have ethical review boards that are supposed to be reviewing this research. So if a researcher wants to study Facebook data or Twitter data, they go to an ethical review board with their proposal, and the review board evaluates it. In this case, the researcher didn't do that. So perhaps a review board would have said this is sensitive data because it's about people's love life or their passions. Maybe we need to get consent, or maybe you should do some anonymization of that data. But because he didn't do that, we have this kind of a debacle that he's faced with. But hopefully, as we start going forward, there's more and more attention being paid to the ethics related to this research. So we can encourage more research like this to happen, but as long as the researchers go through the proper ethical steps.
So you were just at a conference in Cologne, Germany, that was really all about this, was
right.
About the ethics of using this kind of big data. What does one do at a conference like that?
Well, it's a really interesting experience. I've been working and thinking about these issues of what we call internet research ethics for a number of years. And I'm part of a community of scholars that are internet researchers, and we pay pretty good attention to this. But there are more and more disciplines out there in more of what I'll call like a pure computer science or information science, where researchers are doing some amazing computational work, thinking about big data research and those kinds of studies. And they haven't had the thought about research ethics before because they're used to doing just with data and not really thinking about the fact that there's people that are connected to that data. So at this conference, we had a workshop. We were trying to sort of bridge that gap. Get these researchers who are routinely studying the web and social media to step back and think a little bit more about some of the ethical implications of collecting this data, how am I processing this data, how am I releasing it in open repositories, and trying to sort of get change the culture a little bit so they pay more attention to the ethical dimensions. I think it was pretty successful, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Do you think that the companies like OkCupid, like Facebook, who are collecting this data, do you think they have a role in trying to anonymize these big data sets?
Yeah, absolutely. And most of these tech companies want to support research. A lot of them hire researchers and PhDs to help run their companies, and they want to have partnerships with other researchers out there in academia. So they are interested in this. Some of them provide certain levels of access to researchers in order to do that. Twitter recently had some grants that they offered, the competition that the best, couple of different proposals will give you access to our research data to do your proposal. Facebook actually had a representative at this conference talking about internal research ethics at Facebook. As they do more internal research on their users, they want to make sure that they're following ethical principles as well. So internally, they have an ethical process that they follow. And hopefully the technology companies are recognizing the importance of research and the importance of ethics, and we're sort of working together at a solution.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me here in studio.
Great. Thank you so much.
Michael Zimmer is an associate professor at UW-Milwaukee's School of Information Studies, and he's the director of the Center for Information Policy Research. And that wraps up today's All Science edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and each weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.